University of Colorado.
Welcome to See You on the Air, the University of Colorado's podcast. We feature faculty from across CU's four campuses and their interesting, innovative, and sometimes life-changing work.
And so that's what this all came from, was this woman that wanted to donate her body and be sliced and imaged, and then donated her life story and the rest of her life. I didn't feel competent to document her life, so I asked the National Geographic to help. And to my surprise, they said, yes, we'd like to do that, with the understanding that it was for a year. When it drug on to 14 years, they questioned it numerous times.
Hello and welcome to See You on the Air. We're talking today with Dr. Victor Spitzer. He's the director of the Center for Human Simulation at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And he's joining us from the CU Anschutz Medical Campus about an amazing project out here, the Virtual Human. Dr. Spitzer and his team froze, sectioned, and then sliced a body donor named Susan Potter, who died of heart disease at age 87, and now will live on in some 27,000 photos. Welcome, Dr. Spitzer. Happy to have you.
Good afternoon. It's good to be here.
First, tell us, what exactly is a virtual human?
Well, virtual reality is taking over the world. It's related to reality, and I think that's what we really bring closest to the reality is real anatomy, the way that most people are familiar seeing it, with a photographic camera. So we digitize photographs of the entire human body. Well, everything I say isn't true. We try to take those photographs as close together as possible and as high a resolution as possible so that we have tiny little elements of the body. When we have 27,000 pictures, each picture has elements that are only about 50 microns apart.
How far apart is that? Less than the width of a human hair?
On the average of a human hair. Human hairs can be 60, 70, 80 microns. Some are as thin as 10. So we're on the area of a human hair width.
And who was Susan Potter?
Susan Potter was a philanthropist. She gave of her time and her talent, and then her body. I first knew of her as she sat in the lobby of the 9th Avenue campus in front of the chancellor's office and sold Christmas decorations, Easter baskets, any other time that there was some opportunity to sell things to raise money for the chancellor's scholarship fund. That's what she did, from a wheelchair. I didn't know her. I hadn't met her. I interacted with her. I bought flowers from her. I knew of her. In 2002, I met her, and she rolled her wheelchair into my office and said, held up a newspaper and said, I want to do this. I could see the newspaper. I knew what it was about, but I pushed her on, do what? She wanted to donate her body and be sliced and imaged just like the visible human was in 1993, because that's what she thought would be a good way to use her virtual anatomy to teach medical students about anatomy. But the other thing she wanted to teach about was compassion, about the whole body, not just the anatomy, but how you think about it. And that was all she wanted. I said, no, thank you. We're not looking for older bodies. I was still thinking about visible human. And visible human had the requirements of a young body, less than 60 years old. That's young in the cadaver world. She wasn't young, and she was full of pathology. It's not what you use for normal anatomy, but normal anatomy is also about functional anatomy, and she wanted to talk about her mind. So I made her a deal that I would image her if she died properly, if she would allow us to document her life, she could give us the history of up to that point in time, and from now on, document it with video interviews of her, her healthcare providers, her interactions with students. And she said yes. And so that's what this all came from, was this woman that wanted to donate her body and be sliced and imaged, and then donated her life story and the rest of her life. It became quite a project. She promised me she'd be dead in a year. She lasted for 14 years. I didn't feel competent to document her life, so I asked the National Geographic to help. And to my surprise, they said, yes, we'd like to do that, with the understanding that it was for a year. When it drug on to 14 years, they questioned it numerous times.
I'll bet so. A lot of people are uncomfortable, obviously, with dying, and probably more so would be uncomfortable about donating their body to medical science, and probably even more would be uncomfortable about the process of having their body sliced into these thin layers, but she was enthusiastic about it.
She knew all about the slicing and the imaging. What she wasn't prepared for was the public display and the fact that she would be on the internet, as the visible human already was. That part bothered her because she wanted to donate to the University of Colorado, to the medical students here. And after I accused her of being selfish, she quickly, within a short period of time, changed and said, okay, now I understand that this really will be out there for the entire world to see, her entire body, inside and out, in very graphic terms. I mean, we're talking about photography, and so everybody understands photography and the colors that you see inside and outside the body. Not only that, it's a story about her life. And she was willing to share that, always to provide better education to healthcare providers.
And despite some resistance on your part, you became friends.
We did become friends. You have to, over 14 years. And after, we were friends before I knew her, just seeing a lady raising money for the Chancellor Scholarship Fund. That's a friendly act. But we became a lot friendlier than that. Why did I not want to? I've been asked that question so many times that I decided, what's wrong with me? I'm positioning her body and her life so that students can become more friendly with her. Why can't I become more friendly with her? It's just the mindset I was in. If I'm going to cut you up, I don't want to be your friend. But why not? I'm more okay with it now than when we talked about my not wanting to be her friend.
Yeah. Describe for us the dissecting process itself. How does it happen?
For the virtualization, for the visible human, it's a matter of we grind tissue. We take off very thin layers, but we don't try to save what we took off. We save it for cremation later, but we don't try to photograph that. What we photograph is the rest, what's remaining. So you take off a tiny little bit, in this case 63 microns, and take a photograph. And then you do it again and take another photograph. Now, when you take off 63 microns, it would be nice if all the material that you were removing was the same. And our bodies are quite different. We have hard bones and soft tissues. So we make it all hard by freezing the body first. So it's a frozen body, and then we take off thin layers and photograph after every layer. Watching those layers as they change in each photograph, which happens about every minute, is, I think, akin to watching grass grow. Things don't change much when you only remove 63 microns.
How long did that process take?
Well, we did it over about 9 months. We first had to cut her body into four sections because we can't handle anything larger than 20 inches tall, and she wasn't 20 inches tall. So first we cut her into four sections, and then each one of those sections was sectioned and imaged in less than 12 days each. So a total of 48 days for the entire body. But we took breaks in between sections.
You're essentially reverse engineering a human body.
Your terms, and I have used those in the past, and I think that's exactly right. We are taking something apart in one way so that we can assemble it and look at it in different ways. Are we trying to put it back together and make it function? No, but we'd like to make you think it was functioning. Someday we want to simulate her life.
And how does science, how do students benefit from what you've done?
Well, they're already benefiting from the visible human, which was designed to be very normal anatomy. With her, I think we'll extend that, and they'll be looking at her anatomy. They'll see something beyond anatomy. They'll see all the pathology in her body, as well as the normal anatomy at age. Most of our students dissect bodies in her age range, and quite often older. But appreciating them in the unembalmed state, I think, is far more impactful. And you can investigate those changes, being able to look at them in three-dimensional space in virtual reality. I'm not pushing virtual reality to be all that much better than cadaver dissection, but it's quite different. So seeing her pathology, seeing her anatomy, her normal anatomy, her variations in anatomy, seeing her surgeries, and then listening to her talk to you about the pain or the disability that she experienced because of those pathologies and surgeries, I think will have phenomenal impact. Will it have good value? I don't know, but I think it'll have tremendous impact.
Yeah. You were involved on the front end of the project, but it's been an extensive project and continues even now, correct?
That's correct. The Visible Human from 1991, which when the grant was first received, is still being developed. The project itself is over because the project was just sectioning and imaging the body. But now we and others throughout the world are utilizing the data in ways to make it come more to life, virtualizing the anatomy, making the anatomy come to life by making it in motion. Things are starting to move in the Visible Human body. That will happen much faster in Susan Potter's body because we're learning how to interact with the data better.
How has the technology changed since 1991? Not much at all, right?
Well, cameras. The ability to image her, we've now gone from the same priced camera, $50,000. In 1991, we spent the same $50,000, but now we have 22,000 pixels where we used to have 2,000. So we have 10 times the number of pixels in two dimensions, and consequently we cut thinner in the third dimension. So we've increased now by a factor of 100 in three dimensions. So the resolution of the details that we see is much, much better. Some of that detail is not necessary. You don't need that kind of detail to introduce people to anatomy, but it becomes much more important in teaching residents and fellows and even in continuing medical education to teach the fine details of specific parts of the body.
And you mentioned that National Geographic thought this was going to be a one-year project, and 14 years later, they were able to publish something. Did you have to keep them engaged, involved throughout that time?
I absolutely did. There were two times in particular. They changed top editors at the top of the magazine three times during this 14 years. And the current editor confirmed that this was the longest running story they had ever covered. But reselling it to each new editor was a task I didn't directly have to do. It was the science photo editor, Kurt Mutchler, that had to resell it. And he always came back to me for progress in the development of what's happening to convince them to keep after the story, to keep sending the photographer to Colorado to create more images. I gave them more material, but the material they were really fishing for is she dead yet? And that just didn't happen. In fact, Susan, I think, came more to life throughout the project.
When the story did publish in National Geographic, got international attention, did it surprise you, the kind of attention it got?
No, everything in National Geographic gets a lot of attention. What surprised me was the positive reaction. There's always a few negative reactions, but I've tried to survey the responses that they've gotten, and many of them are just comments like awesome and fantastic, and this is really fascinating. Well, those terms are not educational; they're fascinating, and we're not going for fascinating. We're going for educational, but that will come as we identify the parts of her anatomy that we can see and present those to students. That's when the education will come. But there's so many people that were inspired by her donation and the fact that she knew. People are interested in death, and she talked about death. She talked about not being afraid of it. So I think that's what they were fascinated by, and that's part of our education process in medicine too, is trying to introduce people to death. So there's a lot of education there that is wrapped up in the many, many comments that the National Geographic has received in response to the article.
And you said that compassion was a big part of what she and what you hope to achieve. Do you feel like that's happening?
I hope to achieve it. I fought with her about compassion a lot because you're not always given the choice. I mean, we have phenomenal surgeons that are totally non-compassionate. I would like to have competence first and compassion second. Compassion's wonderful, but if it's at the expense of competency, I don't want it. Can we teach people to be both? Well, let's try. So I'm happy to have her try and promote this idea of compassion in our healthcare providers. I think it's part of medicine, but there's other parts to medicine that don't require compassion. If you can accompany it with it, fine. But let's make sure everybody's competent, and then let's try to get them to all be compassionate, and then you have the best of both worlds.
How would your average medical student use a virtual human?
Well, that's changing. They've used the visible human in software, on computers, in three-dimensional displays. Just recently, I've seen the visible human and a little bit of Susan Potter in virtual reality. And what I mean by that is immersive virtual reality. Here at the CU School of Dentistry, Dental Medicine, they have virtual reality systems. And getting this data onto those systems has phenomenal impact that I was surprised by. I've seen the visible human in stereo. I've seen it 3D printed. I've seen it a lot in 2D. But the immersion process of getting you in the environment with the body and the ability to take it apart and put it back together again is overwhelming. I didn't say it was educational. Somebody someday will prove that, but it is powerful. And I think that might have a real future in medical education, as well as possibly therapy, as the technology brings the VR world into commonplace. If everybody knows what VR is, uses it for a lot of different reasons, seeing photographic anatomy in VR is extremely powerful. I've seen a lot of anatomy in VR before that had no impact on me. I didn't even appreciate it because it was built from cartoons, simple things. And that was required because the computing power had to be simple. And now that is increased. And now we're able to show the complexity of the human body at the visible human data level and someday at the Susan Potter data level or beyond.
You have a company called Touch of Life Technologies. It's here at the Fitzsimmons Innovation Community, which is the Bioscience Park adjacent to the CU Anschutz Medical Campus. You conduct visual imaging for anatomical education. You're also looking for ways to fabricate the feeling of living tissue. How is that coming?
We're doing that today, and we've been doing that now for the past 12 years. Our first foray into that in a commercial product was a knee arthroscopy simulator. In knee arthroscopy, the physician sees the inside of the knee, the joint cavity, but they also feel it. And the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons thought that the feeling of the tissues inside the knee was extremely important. So we built a simulator to their specifications so that they could feel around inside the knee to train people how to examine the knee. They made the decision, which we were delighted with, that they wanted the highest fidelity possible, both in what they saw and in what they felt. And so we built our knee simulator using the best haptic devices available at the time. And we still do that. We've extended it to other prototype simulators where you can feel tissues. The important thing about feeling those tissues is you don't have to program it to feel like tissues of the dead. They can be living tissues. And so we allow people to feel the pop of a needle as it goes through the dura as you go into a spinal tap. And those feelings are evaluated as being more realistic than anything experienced in physical models. If you do make something realistic in a physical model, that's great, but not for the next case because the feelings change. You change those feelings in software, but not in hardware so easily. we're excited about that area.
Yeah. With all the technological advances and the virtual human and what you were just describing about the tissue, will all this make the traditional cadaver obsolete?
I hope it does at the level that we use it at today. We pretty much use the cadaver today as the introduction to anatomy. I think it ought to be used for really understanding anatomy after you know it didactically or you know it virtually. And then you can get, I think, more efficiency out of a cadaver and learn more. I don't think it's going to decrease cadaver usage. I think we might even have more with people that require more anatomical knowledge, the surgeons, the radiologists, probing things further in their education. But the virtual reality will, I think, might be the first introduction where you learn a lot of the anatomy and then you bring it closer to the real world and get rid of the virtual world as we still use cadavers. So no, I don't think it's going to replace them, but I think it will change how they're used. It's hard to find young bodies that are donated that don't have pathology or surgery. We save everybody today, and we do a lot of things to keep people living so they have signs of not normal anatomy. Variable anatomy is okay, but abnormal anatomy like changed by surgery, it's not what we want to show all the anatomy. For example, Susan Potter, she doesn't have a gallbladder. Well, it's hard to teach about the gallbladder if you haven't got one. So that's what the visible human was all about, was finding people that had everything and it looked good. The reason why they wanted young is you can see things easier in the young than you can in the aged, most things. We have better developed muscles in the young, and it's just easier to discern things. Things start to stick together and blend together as we get older.
Well, if you're looking for young bodies, I'm happy to donate John Arnold, our sound engineer.
John, let me know when you're ready.
I am a donor.
Talked about how far the Virtual Human Project has come since 1991. What do you see out there in the future in the next, say, 10 years and beyond?
I think 10 years we'll see this kind of data in motion. Do I just want to have the visible human move? There are videos of the visible human moving, but he was programmed to move by moving limbs in certain locations. I mean move because his muscles are contracting. Then you can simulate and study how your gait changes if you take the nerve out of one muscle. When you're flexing your knee, you're using many muscles. If you deinnervate one of the muscles, how does that change how you walk or how you run? If we can make this virtual body react as a living body, then we can study things like placement of where a tendon is attached to a bone, as might change in surgery, or changing how a muscle that's injured would change someone's gait. That's just the musculature, blood flow, flow of any fluids in the body, getting all of the functions of the body to react in a simulated environment. We do it with things we designed, but like you said, we're reverse engineering this body. We have fluids easily flowing through tubes in aircraft that we have the designs for. We're still trying to get those designs of the body from reverse engineering in order to make muscles contract and blood flow.
If Susan Potter could speak to you from beyond the grave, what do you suppose she'd say?
I think she is.
Actually speak.
I think she would be happy with the reactions. I think she would not be pleased with the pictures that showed up of her body because she wasn't too excited about that happening in the first place. There are pictures in the magazine about one of her physical examinations. I never even saw the pictures. They were taken when I told her I didn't want to be there. And those show up there. Well, I have no problem with them being in the magazine because there will be pictures more realistic than that after we reconstruct her dead body, and we'll see on the inside too. So I think she would be happy with it all, but not until students start to get something from it. Is that happening yet? I don't know that it is. When I can get her talking to students about the screws and the wires that they can see in her neck, and describing the process that she went through to get a surgeon to actually do the work. She was turned down by multiple surgeons. We still have the opportunity now to have the surgeon explain the work that he did in her neck in anatomical terms. So we have her viewpoint, his viewpoint, and then the anatomy that that is there that they'll be able to see. That will be interesting for physically for a surgery that wouldn't be done that way today. So it has to be at a different level. It has to be interesting on the anatomy that they historically had to go through in order to do that surgery back in those days. And the fact that it worked for her. It gave her a decent life after that surgery. Yes, it was in a wheelchair, but reconstructing her cervical spine was not a small task. And multiple physicians didn't want to do it.
When will the project be complete?
Over my dead body. I don't think it will be complete. Like the visible human, there's always something more to simulate. I talked about his walking. Well, first we'll get a muscle to contract, which will move two bones. But getting him to contract any muscle that you're trying to simulate normal activity, I don't even think we'll see that in the next 10 years. It's too much computing power we need to simulate the kind of complex motions that we have. But the more Hollywood puts into it, the more we'll get out of it. They love to simulate facial expression of people. And they've actually looked into doing it realistically with true muscle structure. It was too big a task for them in the past, but I think in the future they develop resources that will allow us to make things realistic. So I think a lot of other players will help in this, whether it's their intention or not. They played a big role in the original Visible Human. The Pixar computer was used to reconstruct images of the first Visible Human, and that all came from Star Wars technology.
How about Susan Potter? When will her portion of the project be complete?
It took us 12 years to identify the structures in the visible human male body. I think we can get that done in 3 or 4 years with Susan Potter, or maybe faster. What I'm really looking for now is a grant to fund the management of the data and then try and crowdsource the identification of structures. I think there's a lot of people and very capable people throughout the world that would love to contribute their knowledge about extremely specific parts of the body. There are people that just have studied the temporomandibular joint, and I think for them to identify the structures that they see in there, it's the kind of work that has to be done. It's tedious. It requires a lot of knowledge to identify, but not a lot of knowledge to extend. So once you identify a structure, extending it in three-dimensional space, a lot of other people can do. In other words, having a lot of people work on this for a short period of time is very real, but you've got to manage their results both to reward them with a three-dimensional image of what they're doing and to get something back that you can get along into the functional world so that it can start moving. So I think things will move rather quickly with her because of that.
So thank you, Dr. Spitzer, for joining us today on See You on the Air, and we look forward to following your progress on this fascinating project.
I look forward to you seeing it. I hope we can get it into the shape that people can use it soon.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us for See You on the Air. The University of Colorado comprises 4 campuses, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.